know, the last week of this month, April 28th, I hope to be in Israel. I think I may be in Israel that week. I'll leave after Shabbat on Saturday, and I'll be back on Friday, so it's one of these quick turnarounds. But I got to check in and see how everything is doing. So that'll be the Wednesday, April 28th, there'll be no class. But we've got time till then, several weeks. And we've got.
But then the week after would be the last class. Or
well,
we were trying to figure this out.
When is your
the May 12th.
So May 5th, there's a class, right?
Yes.
The May 12th.
Is your vote.
Is it your vote?
That's what Jay said.
The second?
I looked up compared to the color.
No. May 12th is not Shavuot. May 12th is Yom Yerushalayim. Yom Yerushalayim. May 19th is Shavuot.
Oh, so May 12th would be the last.
May 12th will be the last.
May 12th.
Correct. May 12th will be the last.
We sort of knew what he
meant. When is Yom HaAtzmaut? Yom HaAtzmaut. By the way, for Yom HaShoah and Yom HaAtzmaut, none of the calendars that I've consulted have been correct this year, except the Israeli calendars. But all kinds, you look at a Ramaz calendar, is wrong. Everybody's wrong. Because people haven't internalized the, as our old, we had an executive director, you'll remember, Dan, Barbara. Barbara, she was so smart. And Barbara, she used to say to me, she says, Rabbi, what's the logarithm? I don't know what she's talking about. I said, what do you mean, what's the logarithm? She says, well, you know, there must be a way that you always figure out when the end of Shabbat is. She says, I see candle lighting, but I don't know when the end of Shabbat is. You must use a formula. I said, you mean the formula? She says, yes. So it's always a logarithm for these things. So the logarithm, the issue with Yom HaShoah is that Yom HaShoah is, what's the date of Yom HaShoah? See whether you guys know. It's right. No, what's the Hebrew date?
It's a week.
What's the Hebrew date?
Maybe it should be honestly.
No, you don't.
7 days before maybe, yeah.
No, it's a date in Nisan. It's a classic date in Nisan. Kaf Zayin Nisan, the 27th day of Nisan, for whatever reason. Some say, well, the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, a variety of possibilities. Kaf Zayin Nisan is the date of Yom HaShoah. However, you have to know the logarithm, because it's usually the date of Yom HaShoah. Unless the 27th day of Nisan were to fall out on a Friday, or a Saturday, or a Sunday. So why you said a Sunday? Why should it be a problem on a Sunday? Because major participants in Yom HaShoah have to be, among other people, the Israeli army. Right? The Israeli army. If you have a Sunday, that means that it starts Saturday night. And the soldier, therefore, has to get from home to his base at this time of the year on Saturday night, which will never work. It will never work because they're also on daylight savings time, which means that you can't have programming. The basis will have programming. People will do the Mechilul Shabbat, the desecration of the Sabbath. So therefore, you always have to look ahead and see whether any of these possibilities will happen on the 27th day of Nisan. And as well, you have to know this as far as Israel Independence Day. Everybody got Israel Independence Day wrong in America this year. What's Israel Independence Day? What's the date?
AER.
Okay, so look at the calendar, and I'll tell you when AER is. Let's see, AER. Just a minute. Okay. AER is Monday. AER is Sunday night, Monday. Now, you have to know with Israel Independence Day that the day before Independence Day is Yom HaZikaron. So, if AER falls out on a Monday, Yom HaZikaron falls out on a Sunday. that's specifically directed at the Army, which means that the Army observance would begin Saturday night. So you already know from what I told you that when that happens, you have to push it ahead a day. Therefore, Israel Independence Day, contrary to the calendar, this year is on Vav Iyar. It's on Vav Iyar. But most of the calendars are wrong. My calendar is wrong right here. This is wrong. And the Ramaz calendar was wrong. And most of the calendars in America were wrong.
Yom HaShoah begins Saturday night. I mean Sunday night this year.
Yom HaShoah begins Sunday night this year. That's correct. That's when we have our service. But Kaf Zayin Iyar is Saturday night, not Sunday night. That's why it's pushed ahead a day. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, I've been monitoring the internet on medicine for a few years now.
Right.
Wikipedia is getting better and better, more accurate each year.
Very nice.
I wouldn't be surprised because there's so much editing, and if people get something wrong, they're attacked.
The Federation of Jewish Men's Clubs sent out yellow Yom HaShoah candle.
Right.
They sent it out with a letter, and their letter said, light the candle Sunday night.
Sunday.
I took a look at that, and you know, you're right. All the calendars, Sunday is Yom
HaShoah.
So now you're saying that the men's club got it right.
They got it right. Very good. Good for the men's clubs.
Yeah. Where can you get a calendar that's good?
You have to go and look at it here.
Right here.
You come to Oz Arua.
I come to Oz Arua.
And you haven't been hanging out with it. So you won't make a mistake.
Okay. We get it. Pesach,
the calendar for the spring next year is exactly the same as it was this year. And all of these days, everything I'm telling you now applies next year just as it applies this year. Yom HaShoah is the same thing. Yom HaShoah is the same thing. It's on Vav Iyar next year. Everything is the same. And the key reason for that, I mean, I can't tell you in detail. We have this 19-year complicated calendar, so I really can't tell you the astronomical reason. But normally you don't expect that to happen 2 years in a row. The reason that you have things happening next year which you don't expect is because next year is a leap year. And you have 13 months in the year. And the 13 months in the year just kick everything ahead, and the normal falling back a few days, we're used to it falling back a day or two each year, it's different because you have a leap year. Okay? Solve the problems? Very good. Now we're going to really get into the problems. I think we need to do a quick review of the Mishnah. I'm sure that some of you at least have forgotten what a forward contract is. And you may have forgotten the conditions under which forward contracts are actually permissible, although they're generally prohibited. So we will go through the Mishnah. We'll go through it quickly. Particularly in the Gemara today, if you have the sheet that I handed out on the Torah sources on interest, that will be particularly valuable. As Alan mentioned before, had you been in the synagogue last Friday, you would have heard the reading, which is a Pesach reading. It's a Chol HaMoed reading, which is Leviticus 22, verse 24. Im kesef talve et ami. It's the first on our sources of Torah sources on interest. And the latter part of that reading is about Pesach, the pilgrimage festivals. But it begins, Im kesef talve. If you loan money, you shall not loan money at interest. Okay? Okay, now we're on 60B3. Alright, now. Eizehu nesher ve'eizehu tarbi. We saw when we looked at the biblical sources that there were two different Hebrew words that were translated as interest. For example, it says in Leviticus 22:24, Im kesef talve et ani, if you loan money to my people, et ani unmach, a poor person with you, lo tiye lo kanosher, lo tesimun alav neshek. You shall not be as a creditor. You shall not place upon him neshek. Right, so one of the words that we see is the word for interest is the word neshek. And we, in speculating the source of the word, we saw that it also comes from the Hebrew word noshech. Noshech, to bite. And neshech, interest, bites the borrower. Right? It takes a bite out of his money. So that's the simple understanding of neshech. In Leviticus 25:35, v'chi amuch achicha mata yado imach, if your brother becomes poor and his stretches out his hand with you, v'chazakta bo ger v'toshav achayimach, and you shall act toward him like a stranger, al tikach, don't take me'ito neshech v'tarbit. Don't take from him neshech, we already know what that is, vitarbit, and tarbit. Well, tarbit, we would understand, how would you translate tarbit into another vastly different Hebrew word? It would be neshech. They seem to be synonyms with one another. But here, why would the scriptures then say neshech vitarbit? You shouldn't take from him neshech or tarbit. But yareta melokecha, you shall fear your God, your brother shall live with you. And then it goes on, et kaspecha lo titen lo beneshech. You shall not give him your money beneshech, with interest. Neshech. Uve marbit lo titen ochlecha. And with marbit, or rebit, any of those terms that come out of marbit. Now, barbit comes from the Hebrew word laharbot, something extra. Right? It's some kind of added income. And of course, from the perspective of the one who gives the loan, we might say, well, maybe that's what it means. The one who gives the loan makes money on the loan. The one who takes the loan, he gets bitten. So maybe these are two different, just from two different perspectives. It's another possibility. But the problem we're left with here is that we have these two words. They seem to be used consecutively as if one adds to the other. And we'll have to figure out why. Yes?
Yes, I would translate, let's say I give you a loan, you take a loan for me for 100, I will give you 90, and then you will need to pay me.
Hold off, let's see the way the Talmud. The Talmud will begin to speculate. And you may be right, you may be wrong. Let's see the way the Talmud solves this problem. Okay? Let's keep going. So the Talmud says, Ezehu neshech ve'ezehu tarbit. Which is, what is the meaning of neshech? And what is the meaning of tarbit? Why do we have two terms? Ezehu neshech. It begins to define the terms. Neshech is defined in the following way. Hamalveh sela behe dinari. One who lends sela. That's a coin equal to 4 dinars for 5 dinars. Right? You're borrowing 4, you have to pay back 5. Well, that's obviously, that's interest. So that's neshech. That must be what neshech is. Satayim chitim, if you lend 2 seahs of wheat, b'shalosh, and you get back 3. Okay, so that's, classically, we understand what that's all about. That's what we would call interest. Asur, those are forbidden, mipnei shehu noshech, because it bites the person who has taken the loan. So we know what noshech is. The ezehu tarbit. Now we will go and define the other term, the term tarbit, or rebit. Hamarbe beferot, one who increases his assets through trading produce or other goods. Right? He increases his assets through trading produce or other goods. So in a way, we're tempted to say, well, this must be the person giving the loan. He's going to increase his assets, right? But it's also possible that it could be anyone, either the person who gets the loan or who gives the loan. Both of them could increase their assets in certain ways. Ketzad. How? Lakach emenu chitin bedinar zahav akor. Someone bought wheat, from a seller at a price of 1 gold dinar per kor. That's the amount. Right, a gold dinar being equal to 25 silver dinars. The chen ashar, that was the prevailing market price. The buyer paid for the wheat, but did not take immediate delivery. Amdu chitin belamed dinarim. Right, it started out that this sale was for 25 dinars. Right? Not a sale, a loan. We'll read it again. Lakachi menu chitim. Somebody bought wheat from a seller at a price of 1 gold dinar. The chinashar, that was the market price. The buyer paid for the wheat, but did not take immediate delivery. So the buyer pays for it, but he doesn't take delivery. Amdu chitin belamed dinarim. And in the meantime, the price of wheat goes up. Goes up to 30. Alright, subsequent interest is 30 dinars per kor. Amar lo ten li chitai. So the guy who made the purchase says to the seller, alright, now I want my wheat. Alright, so he paid 25 and he wants it now. What he's going to get is worth 30. Right. Give me my wheat. I want to then sell that wheat and buy wine with the wheat. Of course, he's now able to buy 30 dinars of wine. Right? Because the price has gone up in the meantime. It's the same stuff. The same wheat, but the price has gone up. Question?
No, he made a deal. So who cares when he took delivery? He made a deal to buy X amount for 20 dinars. So he should get X amount for 20 dinars.
Correct. So this is all fine. We're going to say this is kosher. Okay. This is not a problem. We're going to get one case that's not good. But this is perfect. So far it's okay. Amar lo ten lichitai. Give me my wheat. Shani rotzer lemochran velikach behem yayin. I want to sell it and buy wine with the proceeds. Amar lo, harechi techa asuyot alai bishloshim. So the guy who made the original sale says, no, let's do it as a loan. He says, I'll read it again. Amar lo, harechi techa asuyot alai bishloshim. The seller would, the English is good. The seller would indeed be permitted to give him the wheat, but he said instead, your wheat that I owe you is hereby assumed by me as a debt of 30 dinars. So now we're turning this whole thing into a loan. It's being turned here into a loan at 30 dinars.
Did the buyer give a loan to the seller?
The buyer is giving a loan to the seller.
Because first you pay 25, and
if I
keep it 30,
correct.
Now it went up to 30.
Okay, good. And in its place, you hereby have a claim on me for wine worth 30 dinars. He's saying, I'll give you eventually wine for that. I'll give you wine. The yayin ain lo. But he has no wine in his stock. Alright, he's short. Okay. However, the seller has no wine at this time. Rather, he promises to deliver wine at a later date. All right, now let's go back and see what the issue is here in terms of the forward contract. The psika ala perot, a forward contract for produce, I'm reading in the note down on the lower left-hand side. The case that follows in the Mishnah to illustrate the law of Tarbi concerns a forward contract known as psika ala perot. That's the Hebrew term, Pesika ala perot, forward contract for produce. It is an agreement whereby a buyer pays for goods to be delivered at a later date than at a price fixed at the time of the agreement. Okay? That makes sense. A buyer often enters into such a contract to protect himself against future price increases. He can do that. So he's buying futures. Even if the seller anticipates a price increase, he agrees, or let's say he may agree to the arrangement because he has the use of the money in the interim period from payment until delivery. So even if everybody knows the price is going up, the seller still may want to do that because in the meantime he gets paid and he can do something with that money, whatever it is that he wants to do. Therefore, the advance payment is in effect a loan from the buyer to the seller. Look at that. Therefore, the advance payment is in effect a loan from the buyer to the seller for the period from payment until delivery, because he hasn't accepted delivery yet. He hasn't accepted delivery when the buyer receives his goods. If the goods increase in value during this period, the seller will be delivering goods worth more than the amount advanced in payment. Right? The problem here was the delivery. Right, we're assuming then that the moment of delivery is crucial in deciding whose wheat it is.
How do we reconcile that with the statement that it's okay? So forget about the wine. Even with the wheat, we have payment in advance.
Correct.
Then delivery would come later at a time when the wheat has increased in value.
Mm-hmm.
And it says the seller would indeed be permitted to give him the wheat.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But he would be giving him something, that seems to be exactly what you're not allowed to do. He'd be giving him 30 dinars worth of wheat, even though the guy had only given him 25 dinars up front. So he's in effect paying him interest.
Wait, we've got to go further. Let's go a little bit further, because we're going to see that this is okay in certain circumstances. Let's see what the circumstances are. Right, go further. If the goods increase in value during this period, the seller will be delivering goods worth more than the amount advanced in payment. That seems like a problem, right? Seems like a problem. By rabbinic law, this constitutes an interest payment, okay, exactly what you're saying, for the seller's use of the money. So this should be forbidden. Should be forbidden. Because of this possibility of a price increase, the rabbis generally forbade any advance payment in forward contracts, i.e. contracts made for future delivery. Hold on. You've got to get a little further. However, okay, this is the key stuff that's coming up. These are the exceptions to the rules. Because the question is, how much should they legislate? How much should the rabbis legislate? You know, you've got a complicated transaction here. Is this really the law of the Torah? Or is this a rabbinic legislation to see what is perhaps not clearly a case of interest, but something that is like interest? So is this enough like interest so that we should forbid it? Well, we might. However is crucial. Contract of this type is permitted if either now, underline the word either, two conditions is met. First, it is permitted if the seller has the goods that were ordered in stock at the time of the agreement. In such a case, it is viewed as if the buyer took possession of the goods at the time of the payment, even though he does not take delivery of them. So we can understand that. You know, I can buy goods from you. It could be in your storehouse, and yet I can have possession. I can own them. They can be mine, even though they're located in your storehouse. So if the goods actually physically exist, we can look at this whole thing as if that's what's happening and say, well, he's taken possession even though it's in someone else's location. The buyer takes possession of the goods at the time of the payment, even though he does not take delivery of them. Okay? Hence, any subsequent increase in their value is viewed as having occurred under the buyer's ownership. Right? The buyer owned them, even though they were in the seller's storehouse. He didn't take delivery. And there's no question of interest payment. So it's not an interest payment. So that's exception number one now, is if at the time of the sale, there the goods were present. The goods were physically present. This condition is referred to the Gemara as Yeshlo. It's a good way to refer to it. Yeshlo. He has them. He already has the goods. The seller has the goods. Secondly, the transaction is permitted when the stipulated price represents the established market price at the time. Right? There could be a stipulated price, whatever it is. If it's an established market price, then it's all okay. In this case, even if the seller does not have the goods in stock, he could easily acquire them with the money he receives from the customer. And it is such a clear established market price. This is making the assumption that the goods are available also. I mean, we would assume that. It's a clear market price. It's not anything that anyone wonders about. He could easily acquire them with the money he receives from the customer. It is therefore again viewed, we have now a second case, as if the buyer has taken possession of the goods at the time of the agreement. Even though he hasn't taken delivery of them, he's taken theoretical possession of them. It is essential, however, that the price be stable and well established so that the goods are readily available at that price. Now, that's at the time when the transaction takes place, not when the delivery takes place, because delivery can be worth a totally different price. Otherwise, there's no assurance that the seller could obtain the goods with the money paid him, since their price might rise before he has a chance to buy them. This condition is known as Yatsa HaSha'ar. There is a prevailing price. I would translate it prevailing market price. There is a prevailing and well-known market price. When either of these two conditions is satisfied, a forward contract is permitted, and the seller may later deliver the goods, even if the value at the time of the delivery is more than the original purchase price. Is that clear now? Okay? And it makes sense, because we simply interpret that the delivery hasn't taken place, but there has been, in effect, possession, that the purchaser has taken possession, even though he hasn't taken delivery. No? Well, because of the amount of time. Time could pass. And the assumption is that we're talking market price in terms of the amount, a relatively short period of time. And now we're saying it could be a month later, it could be a year later. Okay? Yes.
What constitutes a sale?
That's a good point. That's a good question.
When they pay for the goods or when they take possession?
It's not clear. It's not clear. That is a matter of dispute, and that is at the beginning of the chapter that we started with, but we didn't start at the beginning. There, one of the questions was, what constitutes a sale? Because there's a biblical idea of sale, and then there is a Talmudic idea of sale, and they are the opposite. And the reason why they are the opposite is that the biblical idea of sale was not effective. So the rabbis change it to a more effective notion of sale. But in effect, what that means is that it's possible that either payment or delivery, depending upon the circumstances, may possibly constitute sale. Okay?
So if the buyer of the wheat has taken possession but not delivery, how can the seller say to him, well, I'm not going to give you the wheat, instead I'm going to give you this IOU in wine?
Because he, at this point, he says to the seller, he says, look, I want to buy the wheat. I want the delivery of the wheat now because I need wine. I don't need wheat, I need wine. So he says, it's a lot easier if...
Oh, so you can only say that because the buyer has indicated...
Exactly.
That he's ultimately going to use the money.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. But couldn't the buyer owns the wheat, so couldn't he insist, well, it's my wheat, I'm taking it?
Oh, he could. He could definitely take it. But this is where he decides he doesn't... The seller gives him an offer. They skip a step.
They make more money selling him wine.
Right. Skip a step.
What happened if the market rate of the chita, the wheat, is going down? So... Mm-hmm. To give him more wheat.
The law is concerned with the possibility of the market price going up. You are quite right that just as the market price can go up, the market price could go down. But interestingly enough, the law is not concerned with that. The law is not concerned. The law is concerned with the possibility that it goes up. Again, you're dealing here with rabbinic law. You're not dealing with the law of the Torah. Rabbinic law that is concerned about doing something that may be tantamount to something the Torah forbids. So it simply takes different types of transactions without knowing the ultimate outcome. Because the outcome could be different if it goes up or it goes down.
There's no direction.
Correct, correct. So we don't know what that outcome is going to be. But the rabbis ab initio prohibit these transactions lest one of the outcomes end up being something that we could call tarbit. Tarbit, which is to say that the seller will eventually get an increase in what appears to be a loan. Okay? In effect, it turns out to be more almost a loan. And he has now an increase in what he's getting for it. Okay?
Going back to rabbinic law as opposed to the Torah, this is during Roman period. What was the Roman feeling towards interest?
I don't know.
Did it add at all?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question.
Go ask the Jews.
That's a good question. I would be very surprised if it's anything like this, because the reason why you have what we are dealing with is because of the Torah. The Torah, and the Torah is a lot before that. This in Kesef Talve, this is contemporaneous with the Code of Hammurabi. Right? That's Parshat Mishpatim. So the Code of Hammurabi long precedes Roman law by over about 1,500 years. 1,500 years before Roman law. So my suspicion is that I'd be surprised if this were in Roman law. But it's also not, it doesn't make good sense. It's not good for the economy to have all these roadblocks getting in the way of normal economic transactions. So there may be, we've seen that the Torah has other concerns. I'm not at all sure that you would come up with anything like this if you were interested in a smoothly functioning economy.
The rabbis go about contradicting the Torah. It would seem to me okay to be a great leap in something, faith, arrogance, or something to say, you know, well, we're just not going to pay any attention to this people.
No, they don't. They never say that. They add to the law. By adding to the law, you can structure things which will simply, and there's got to be a reason for it, of course. If you find, for example, that the original purpose of the law didn't work, so you can then restructure things. Rabbis have every power to restructure things in order usually to achieve the goals of the Torah law. But that's got to be clear that they're achieving those goals to the extent that you can ascertain what those goals are. You can't always ascertain them. Sometimes you can.
There aren't a lot.
But here the case, I assume you're referring to the question that you asked before in terms of the what constitutes a sale. I'll say very simply what the issue is there. The sale... The original notion of sale has to do with payment. But certain types of things can be owned on the basis of payment. The problem with that is if you don't have delivery, then it's very difficult because the one who still has possession has no incentive to care for the product that's in his possession. There's no incentive for that. So the Rambam has tried to create a situation where the person who has physical possession, even if he doesn't have legal possession, will still have an incentive to care for the goods that are on his premises. Now that they could have a right to, the rabbis can construct things like that, because ultimately what they found was that a man would buy something with money. He would say, well, so then the guy's barn would burn down. He said, well, you lost, it's too bad. But the guy who owned it said, well, why didn't you take care of the barn? You had a cow in there that kicked over, a lamp. And that's your job. He says, no, it's not my job. You own the wheat. You left it with me. It's yours. Too bad. You lost. The rabbis didn't like a situation like that. They wanted people to be responsible, whether they were the rightful owners or the ones who were in possession, in actual possession. That's why they deal with the law in that particular case. In this particular case, it's different. You'll see shortly the theory, and you'll see the theory why there is such an extension of the law here. I think it's not entirely evident, but at least I will press a certain theory of why this all happens. Yes.
If I understand correctly, the second permitted condition looks like an outright loan. Loans are permitted.
Loans are permitted, but the problem is to make money on the loan.
Well, here, yeah. So here, the assumption is that if we still with the 30 things.
Right. You start out with 25, and it's worth 30 right.
now. So
okay.
Now he's saying to him, let's say the price of the wine is known.
Right.
It's stable.
Okay.
Stable doesn't mean it doesn't go up.
Yeah. It's stable.
So they're saying, I think, that, okay, whenever delivery is made, I have to give you the quantity of wine that made up at the time we did this 30 dinars worth of wine. But I'm not going to give it to you now. I'm going to keep the value. So when it comes time to pay, if you get 35 things, bottles of wine when you previously got 30, the buyer gets 30. But the sellers have the use of the money, and he makes 5. So that's what's prohibited, I think.
That's a problem. Okay. Well, but we'll see. We already saw that there are exceptions here. Let's keep going in the notes. The notes are very good. Let's stick with the notes a little while longer. Hold on a little bit until we get a little bit further in the notes. Keep going. All right. So far it's okay. Now let's see note 7. Let me see what that is too. Here is 7 in the text. Just want to keep going. 3, 4, 5, or 7. Chaynashar. All right, let's go. Ezehu Tarbit, Amardeb, as I wrote, one who increases his effort, sets through trading produce or other goods, Ketzad, Akachem Menuchitim Bidinar Zahavkor. Someone bought wheat from a seller at the price of 1 gold dinar, which is 25 silver. 25 is the number we have to remember. Echein Hashar, and that was the prevailing market price, and I'm going down to the note. He stipulated that he would draw wheat against his account through the year. Since the wheat was sold for the prevailing price, this transaction is permitted, as explained in note 5. Okay? That's okay. Amdu chitin belama dinarim. The price of wheat subsequently increased and stood at 30 silver dinars per kor. Amar lo ten li chitai. The buyer said to the seller, give me my wheat. Shani rotze lemochran velikach behem yayin. Because I wish to sell it and buy with it with the wine with the proceeds. Amar lo. Harechitecha asuyot alai bishloshim. The seller would indeed be permitted to give him the wheat, but he says, let's say, code number 8, even though the wheat is now worth 5 dinars more than the buyer paid for it, since the buyer bought the wheat for the market price that prevailed at the time of the payment, remember that? Right, that was our stipulation number 2. The condition of yatsa hasha'ar, there's a prevailing market price at the time of the payment, the existence of a prevailing price was satisfied, and the transaction is permissible, as explained in note 5. Okay, so we're still good. But he said instead, your wheat that I owe you is hereby assumed by me as a debt of 30 silver dinars. Now we're turning it into a debt, to a loan. Harelecha etzli bahen yayin. And in its place, You hereby have a claim on me for wine worth 30 dinars. Number 9. It would be permissible for the seller at this point to substitute wine worth 30 dinars for the wedios and deliver it to the buyer. Right? It is only the next factor that presents a question of ribit. Okay? The yayin ain lo.
Ah.
Now we have one fact that we know is no longer in the exception group. Yayin ain lo. He has no wine.
Only in yeshlo.
All right? It's not yeshlo. It's ain lo. Exactly. Okay? Yayin ain lo. However, the seller has no wine in stock at this time. Rather, he promises to deliver wine at a later date. Okay? Number 10. Present, the seller wishes to deliver neither wheat nor wine. Instead, he agrees to enter into a forward contract for a quantity of wine worth 30 dinars at today's price. This, again, is a case of pisika ala perot. This is a forward contract. And it is not necessarily forbidden. Ah! Why? If the seller would presently have wine, he would satisfy the condition of yeshlo. But we know he doesn't have wine, right? All right? Having the wine in stock and the transition would be indeed be permitted. However, in the case at hand, the seller has no wine at the present time. The Mishnah states that the transaction is therefore forbidden.
No, but if the shahr is known...
Well, wait a second. Because, wait a second. Hold on, we didn't get to that yet. You're right. So far as this one condition goes, it's not yeshlo, so it seems like a problem. But you're correct. There could be another condition here, right? The Mishnah states that the transaction is therefore forbidden because of the possibility of increase in the price of the wine. So let's keep going. That was number 10. Number 10. This presents a problem because the price of wine might increase in the interim. Should this in fact happen, the increased value of the wine delivered would represent a payment of interest on the 30 dinars he owes the buyer. The transaction is therefore forbidden as a case of parbit, since the buyer's assets are hereby increased. Now I'm going to read 11 and 12. Go down with it. If the price of wine increases before the delivery date, the seller will be delivering wine worth more than 30 dinars he owes. This extra amount represents interest on the use of 30 dinars until delivery of the goods. Transaction is therefore forbidden. Actually, there is a factor that should permit the transaction in this case. Namely, the existence of a stable market price. That's what you had seen. Right? We only saw one of the stipulations not being in fact the case. But you are right to say, but how about the other one? There's a stable market price. This is the condition known as Yatzah HaShar, prevailing market price, as explained in Note 5. Nevertheless, our Mishnah prohibits the transaction. Now, of course, you're wondering why. And the Gemara on Daf 62 has the same problem. So the Gemara will explain. But here the note is going to give you a fast-forward preview of what you will find on Daf Samach Bet. The Gemara 62b will explain that the condition of a prevailing market price can serve as grounds for permitting a forward contract only when a cash payment is made at the time of the agreement. There, it further refines the notion of prevailing market price. It says prevailing market price only makes sense where, in fact, a payment is actually made. Right? Then you can have a notion of a prevailing market price. In that case, the seller can be expected to acquire the goods immediately. Right? Because if you have money paid, you can acquire the goods. And whether you have them or not at the moment, if there's a prevailing market price, you'd have the money and you could acquire the goods with the money he received from the buyer. And we therefore view the situation as one in which the buyer acquired the wine immediately, as explained in Note 5. However, in the case of the Mishnah, no cash was paid at the time they agreed on the contract of wine. That's the problem. No cash was paid. And therefore, exception number 2 cannot pertain. Okay? Rather, the contract was in lieu of payment of the debt of wheat. Since the seller receives no funds at the time of the agreement, he might not be in a position to purchase the goods.
But it was a bundle. He got the wheat.
He can sell the wheat because he doesn't have
to sell the wheat.
He can
that's
sell
not
the
correct.
Wheat and turn the wheat into money.
That's a prevailing market, and this is prevailing market, and it's
yeah, but this is not what we're doing. The Gemara is later going to have to take the Gemara's analysis. We just got a fast forward of the Gemara's conclusion. Gemara doesn't come to conclusions very simply. But I think the point is a rational point, and we can understand the point that in order to have these exceptions, there are stipulations to those exceptions. And the exception requires a payment to be made. Okay? Okay.
There's also a strange notion, in my view, in the Mishnah, where you have the seller sort of at his option saying, well, I'm not going to give you the wheat that you bought, even though I'm obligated to. Rather, I'm going to buy wine, use it to buy wine.
It's not unilateral. That's because the buyer has said he wants to buy wine. No, the buyer says, I want to buy wine. Yeah, he says, give me my wheat, I want to buy wine with it. He says, I don't have to give you your wheat, I'll give you the wine. Okay, we can make another deal. Okay, so that's how it happens. That's how it happens.
I don't know that the seller of the wheat actually
have to assume. We have to assume, because the Gemara is assuming that we have a notion here where there are two possible exceptions. And it is trying to define cases in terms of those possible exceptions, because of those exceptions, if neither of those exceptions pertains, and it's likely that the Mishnah, the Gemara is understanding that the Mishnah likely makes sense, or else it wouldn't say what it wouldn't be there. So it's got to make sense. So the question is, since we know that we have these two possible exceptions, right? This has got to be a situation, and that's what we'll try to do on Samach Bet, is try to figure out, well, why is this not a case of a stable market price? Then it raises the other issue, which is that a payment actually has to be made. And it seems to me that's a reasonable way to go about it, because the whole idea of the stable market price is that there be a possibility of actually buying goods and having those goods there. So if there is no money, then you can't do that. It becomes more complicated. Now let's just step back a second.
As a two cases, one permitted, one not permitted, but it's constructed as essentially a single transaction. Could have presented us with two different transactions. One case, a guy prepays, another guy...
Let's think, why the Mishnah, what the Mishnah is doing. Let's see what the purpose
of
the
Mishnah is. They don't want to stretch it too far.
What is the Mishnah doing? Remember what the Mishnah said at the beginning. Remember what the Mishnah said at the beginning. Mishnah says at the beginning, Ezehu Neshech, the Ezehu Tarbit. Okay? What is Neshech and what is Tarbit? The first definition was fairly simple. The definition of Neshech was fairly simple. It's a loan, and you pay back more than you got in the loan. That's Neshech. Okay? Obviously, Tarbit is something far more subtle. Okay? Question that I would be left with after seeing the extent to which this is subtle is this what the Torah is talking about? Is this really what the Torah is saying? Is this Torah law? Is this rabbinic law? That's the question I think the Gemara is beginning, after it's seen this, and it's seen how subtle, and the example that's given is so abstruse, such a very abstruse example, that that's just the way the Mishnah does a setup. There's a setup now. And you want to, since you've been set up to wonder, you've now got to resolve certain issues. Because on the one hand, it told you what Meshech was and what Tarbit was, and you sort of know, but you really set up to ask a whole series of additional questions. You want to know, you know, why? And could this possibly be what the Torah is talking about? The Torah really forbids all of these things, even these very, very subtle things that sort of just look like situations in Meshech. Is this really what it is? Okay. So that's the way I read the Mishnah. The Mishnah is, in a way, a setup. And it's so highly abstruse in order to provide that setup. And just take a look at what the Gemara does. Okay? Let's go on to Gemara.
Okay.
Gemara says, Mi dishavik l'rabit yoraita. Immediately, the Gemara raises the question of oraita. Oraita is the Torah. Right? The Gemara wants to know what is this that's going on here. Since the Mishnah and its example of Tarbit, the second example we had, the very abstruse example, in that example, Mid the Shavak Liri Bit the Oraita, since the Mishnah and its example of Tarbit, departs from interest that is forbidden by biblical law, okay, interest on loans, the Kamefaresh de Rabbanan, and illustrates it with a case that is forbidden only by rabbinic law, i.e. interest realized through trade, Niklau, the Oraita de Meshech de Tarbit Chada Miltehi. It's a very interesting and almost odd conclusion. If what we are seeing here, if we understand the fact that the first part of the Mishnah is simple, it's obvious that this is interest. The second part is perhaps a rabbinic construct. And maybe, you know, that's what we're talking about in the Mishnah, that Meshech means interest. Tarbit means some rabbinic construction. But that doesn't make sense. You know why? Because the Torah itself uses both terms. And if you want to say to me that Tarbit is a rabbinic construction, okay, fine. But what am I going to do with the fact that the Torah itself uses both those words? It doesn't know what the rabbis are talking about. It's the Torah. So on the one hand, we're tempted to see this as two different types of law. And they seem obviously to be two different types of law. And yet, if they are two different types of law, how can both words be used in the Torah in the same verse? So it's a good question. It's really a good question. And that's forced by the abstruse nature of the example brought in the Mishnah, which is clearly an issue of rabbinic law. It must therefore follow, logically, that in the Torah itself, those two words have exactly the same meaning. And they're just synonyms, one for the other. So that what we see is called Neshech in the Mishnah, also is called Tarbit in the Torah. And it's only in rabbinic law that a difference is made between them. Right? That's possible. But then the Gemara says, "Vaha krae ketivei." But surely there are verses in Scripture which differentiate between neshech and tarbit. Neshech kesef v'ribit olcha. One of the differences, maybe, is that here, let's see, Leviticus 25, the second example, when your brother becomes poor and stretches out his hand to you, verse 36, do not take from him both these things, one is Meshech and the other one is Tarbit, and I take either one. The Yareta Melokecha, you shall fear your God, the Chayachichimach, your fellow shall live with you. Et Kastacha lo titen lo b'neshach. Do not give him your money at Neshech. Uve Marbit lo titen ochlecha. And with Marbit, don't give him your food. So now the Gemara is saying, maybe the difference between these two is that one, namely Neshech, pertains to money, and Tarbit pertains to food. Because specifically, Neshech is used in relation to money, and Marbit lo titen ochlecha, your food. So maybe that's the difference between the two. Right? So it can't be what we saw in the Mishnah. That's rabbinic, a rabbinic difference. We've got to find some difference that makes sense for the Torah itself.
Wasn't the next verse
in
Neshech with
Ocho? Yeah, it's a Karibu. The Gemara is going to immediately reject that because of what you just said. Okay. Vitizber, do you really think the Ika Neshech, well, it has a slightly different argument for us. Do you really think the Ika Neshech below Tarbit? Yeah, that's it. It's going to answer your question a little bit further on. Okay, and it, I see it's note number 15 just gives you the two prohibitions against lending on interest are noted here, one with respect to money and the second with respect to food. The Torah uses a different term for interest with each. The use of the term neshech, specifically with regard to money, and marbit with regard to food, is not in itself significant because, as the Gemara will explain below, both terms apply equally to money and food. That's what you're saying. Okay. What is significant is that the Torah employs two different terms for interest, neshech and marbit, using two separate prohibitions. This seems to suggest that they are indeed independent prohibitions. That seems to be the case so far. But you've got two different terms. They're used in a variety of different contexts, and it appears that there are two different prohibitions, even though we can't figure out what they are. And we're going to test this. The Gemara doesn't necessarily prove anything, it tests things. So it's going to test them. So it's going to test one possibility. It's going to test the possibility that Neshech and Tarbit are perhaps independent one of the other. And perhaps in transactions, there is one thing called Neshech and the other called Tarbit. And that you can have one without the other. That you could have one without the other. Do you really think, Tisbara, the Ika Neshech below Tarbit, that there exists a case? Okay. Time to count the Omer. Okay. Yesterday we counted the eighth day of the Omer. Oh, Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kiddushanu lemitzvotav v'tzivanu al sfirat haomer. Hayom tishah yamim shehem shavu echad u'shnei yamim laomer. This is now 9 days, making 1 week and 2 days of the Omer. Harachamanu yachazir lano avodat bet hamikdash b'mkoma b'mehera b'yameinu amen. Sela. Okay. 9 days to the Omer. No, it's a different Sela. Okay. Okay, let's get through this one. Ika Neshech below Tarbit. Do you think that there exists a case involved in Neshech, biting, biting the borrower without target, increasing the wealth of the lender. Okay? The tarbit below neshech, or a case involving tarbit increasing the wealth of the lender without neshech biting the borrower. Right? Normally, we think that in a normal loan situation where there's interest paid, there are two sides to it. Right? The borrower is bitten; he pays neshech. The lender increases his wealth. That's tarbit, is an increase. So it would seem that that's always got to be the case. So the Gemara says, well, maybe it's not always the case. Is it possible to have one with the other? And therefore we would have a case of neshech and a case of tarbit. Since we have two words, maybe there are two different cases. And it's possible to have one without the other. All right? Now the Gemara will give us a case where there's neshech without tarbit. This is cool. We got to listen. You got to pay attention to this because it's a little hard. If the case that you have in mind is, for example, that someone lent 100 prutot for repayment of 120 prutot, okay? Right. So you lend 100. For repayment of 120. But the value of the prutot then changed during the course of the loan in one of the following ways. Because the value could change. Let me just see. Somewhere is a good note. Let's read the notes with this, because maybe the next note that's good. Had their value remained constant, the load of 100 prutot for 120 prutot would certainly constitute both neshech and tarbit, right? Because the borrower would be paying 20 more than he got. So he would be bitten. The lender would be getting 20 more than he gave. So he would be increasing his wealth, tarbit. Right? So that would clearly be forbidden, since the lender would gain and the borrower would be paying more than he received. Thus, to propose a case of neshech without tarbit, or tarbit without neshech, we must resort to a case where the value of the coins change during the course of the loan. The value of the coins change. Me'ikar l'kaimei me'a bedanka. Originally, at the time of the loan, the rate of exchange was 100 prutot to a danka. Right? 100 prutot to a danka was the exchange rate. A danka, otherwise known as a mea, is a silver coin equal to 1/6 of a dinar. A pruta is a copper coin. Now listen to this. At the time of the loan, the rate of exchange was 100 copper prutot to 1 silver danka. Now let's read the next note too. As we learned at the beginning of the last chapter, the standard of currency was silver. The rate of exchange between copper coins and silver coins was not fixed, but fluctuated according to the market. So that's the complication here. Since monetary value is measured in terms of silver, copper coins, although legal tender, are legally treated as a commodity in comparison to silver coins. Thus, when the rate of exchange changes, for instance, from 100 to 100 prutot to a danka, prutot is a copper coin, okay? Changes from 100 to 120 prutot to danka. The worth of the silver danka is viewed as having remained constant. It's still one danka. But it's a different number of prutot that make up that same danka. While the copper prutot are viewed as having depreciated. Right? The copper prutot have depreciated. So, since that was the reality of their monetary system, we will now see a unique case. So we started out here. Originally, at the time of the loan, the rate of exchange was 100 prutot to a danka. Ulavasov, kaimei mea ve'esrin bedanka. Right? It was 120 per danka. Okay? Neshech ika. Right? In that case, the guy who is paying back the loan, he ends up paying back more.
Yeah, but it's the same value.
Not from his perspective, necessarily. He's paying more, so he's bitten more. But it is also the same value. We're simply trying to find a case where, in fact, there are two different sides to this case. There's a side that is the same and a side that's different. Whereas normally we wouldn't conceive of that. But it is possible if we have the danka, and that danka changes value. It is possible to look at it this way. Your answer is a possible answer. The Gemara will give you that answer. The Gemara is going to reject this possibility. Remember, the Gemara is setting up a possibility here to say, well, you are telling me that you could, maybe we can have a case that is Meshech without Tarbit, and a case that is Tarbit without Meshech. Right? Maybe it's possible, because we have two different words in the Torah. Eventually, I can tell you even right now what the Gemara is going to say. This is wrong. It's not true. Not true, but it is a certain logic to it. Let's see where it goes. Neshech Iker, accordingly, you would maintain that there is Neshech. Deka Nachitle, because the lender bites the borrower. Right? Deka Shakil Mine needed the Loyahi, in that he takes back from him something that he did not give him. The Tarbit Leka, but there is no gain on the part of the lender, right? Because he has no profit out of the transaction. He simply gets back a danka. Gets back a danka. The danka ose the danka kashakilmine. He loans out a danka, and a danka is what he gets back. Okay? Now, of course, the Gemara rejects this. The Gemara rejects this. Self, it says, no matter how you look at this, in the final transaction, if you judge the payment in terms of the rate of exchange that prevailed at the beginning when the loan was made, there are both of them. If you got to look at this thing as happening either at the beginning, you're trying to separate the beginning from the end. It's not realistic. Either you look at the beginning or you look at the end. If you look at the beginning, it's a case of both Neshech and Tarbit. If you look at the end, there's neither Neshech or Tarbit. Alright? In which case, this is a false possibility. So we have to go on. Right? This doesn't work. That's all. We're only trying to see whether it works. Okay? Lo Neshech Ika v'lo Tarbit Ika. It is, if you look at the beginning, the end, then it's neither Neshech or Tarbit. Okay? Having rejected the proposal that there exists a case of Neshech without Tarbit, the Gemara will now go on and give us a case where there's Tarbit without Neshech. It will set up another theoretical possibility, similar to the one we just saw, but with a different outcome, different potential outcome. Look at this one. The two Tarbit below Neshech, Hechidami. How would you imagine a case where there could be Tarbit without Neshech? Namely, the lender would make money without it biting into the borrower? Well, similarly. If the case you have in mind is that someone lent 100 prutot for repayment of the same amount, 100 prutot. Me'ikara kaine mea bedanka. However, originally at the time of the loan, the rate of exchange was 100 prutot to a danka. Ulevasof mea bechumsha. But in the end, at the time of the repayment, the rate was 100 prutot for a fifth of the dinar, which is more than a danka. This case can be construed as constituting tarbit without neshech. It is not neshech because the lender lends 100 prutot for 100 prutot and thus does not bite the borrower by imposing upon him a charge for his money. On the other hand, it is tarbit because the lender does increase his assets by the transaction. At the time of the repayment, he receives one-fifth of the dinar as opposed to the one-sixth of the dinar that he lent. Right? That's just, again, there's a change in the value of this thing. Do you think the Gemara likes this? No way. Ibatar meikara asla. If you judge the repayment in terms of the rate of exchange at the beginning of the transaction, Lo neshech ikavah lo tarbitek. There is neither neshech or tarbitek. Ibatar sof asla, but if you go ahead to the end of the transaction, hare neshech bahare tarbit. There is both neshech and tarbit. Alright? So what the Gemara has done now is to just raise a theoretical possibility, and it was trying to solve a problem in the Torah text. The Torah, remember, has two terms. And it simply tried now to raise the possibility that the two terms there are for two different situations, that you can have one without the other. If you can't have one without the other, then in effect they equal the same thing. Okay? So it's right back where it started. It's still trying to find now, why do we have two different types of terminology here for what's going on? Ella Amar Rava. Rava said, "He atamot say lo neshech v'lo tarbit, v'lo tarbit v'lo neshech." You will not find a case in biblical law of neshech without tarbit, nor a case of tarbit without neshech. And the different terms found in Scripture should not be taken as indication that they have separate applications. V'lo chilkan nakatuv ela la'avor alav bishnei lavin. Scripture divided them into two categories only so that one should be liable in every transaction for violating two separate prohibitions.
Exactly.
So that you'll be guilty of two counts of the same crime. It's really quite astonishing. Quite astonishing. The whole thing here is so horrendous. It's so awful. The whole idea of interest is so awful that you get punished twice for the same crime. That's normally something you would never expect. So, but that's the conclusion that Rava comes to. That in fact this is the reason that they mean the same thing. They don't mean anything different. And instead they are giving twice the force to a single prohibition. It's a very unusual case, which means this must be a very terrible thing. Okay? That's certainly not intuitive, but it appears to be the conclusion that Rava has come to. Yes?
I don't know, they are not touching it in this discussion at all, but Neshech, let's say, it's a one-function loan that you pay in one payment. And maybe the Tarbit, especially when they talk about offer of food, is installment of prepayment. And they didn't want people to pay installment on food that they ate a week ago.
Very nice idea, that's not what the Gemara thinks.
They don't talk about it.
Correct, they don't talk about it. So it seems not to be what they were thinking about.
Could you also think about Tarbit as maybe a word that rabbis borrowed from the Torah to indicate when it's going to be a rabbinic ruling on interest?
That's correct. That's true. It appears to be the case that the rabbis borrow that term in order to create things that are like interest, situations that are enough like interest that they want to prohibit it. But from Rava's conclusion here, in the Torah itself, essentially they have the same meaning. Okay?
If the Torah had been written today, you could have explained it by tax on interest. A person could pay interest and get a bite, but the person who loaned the money would have to pay so much tax on the interest that he wouldn't increase it in birth.
That's a good idea. Very good.
Does the person who agrees to terms of a loan, he agrees to pay interest, is he committing a transgression as well? Or only the lender?
Well, we'll have to see. That's a good question. It's not clear at this point. All right? So far, it appears to be the lender. It appears to be the lender. But I don't think it's that simple. I think it's worthwhile to think about this. Because if you become a party to something from which you can benefit, a transaction which is in itself an illegal transaction, then you are benefiting from something that is illegal, and you therefore have committed a transgression on your own. Right? So, you, correct. So, it's not the same thing, but it's not separate. Okay? Yes. Yes, well, no, in truth, in where, look, the reality is that the Jews that are concerned about this are numerically a very small group of people. In Israel, you have a bank, Mizrahi Bank. It's a relatively small bank. You know, I've been teaching the Netziv, right? And the Tziv, Rabbi Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. His son was Rabbi Meir Berlin. Okay, that's his son. His son grows up in Volozhin, where the father was the head of the yeshiva in Volozhin. Meir Berlin gets involved in the Zionist movement. You can see his father's very modern. I mean, he's both one of these guys, he's a transitional figure. That's why I'm so crazy about it. I'm lost. I'm going to spend the rest of my life in transitional figures. That's how this Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin is. Sons of transitional figures are less transitional than their fathers. So in this case, the son already is bitten by the Zionist bug. He goes on Aliyah. And he becomes the leader of the Mizrahi Party. That's why when the Mizrahi Party decides that it's going to set up a university, they call that university Bar Ilan. Bar Ilan University is named after Meir Berlin, Bar Ilan. He changed his name when he went on Med Aliyah. The father was Zvi, Rabbi Naftali Zvi Yehuda Berlin. The son changed the name to Bar Ilan. He was not the founder of the university, but when the university was founded, they named it after Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan, the son of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Okay? Amazing. So he was the leader of the Mizrahi. The Mizrahi set up the Mizrahi Bank. The Mizrahi Bank had to figure out how to work laws according to the Torah, and how to create what appeared to be loans at perhaps with interest, but without it being interest. I mentioned when we first looked at this that you have in the back of our book a section called the Heter Iska. It's in the appendix at the back of the book. And the Heter Iska is what we have in Jewish law. Also, the basis of Islamic business transactions, and the ones who are really known for this today are the Muslims, because I don't have to tell you they're a major financial force in the world. The Mizrahi Bank, in contrast, is a drop in the bucket. So the Muslims and these kinds of contracts, I know my wife had to write contracts when she was working in a law firm. She had to do some of these contracts for Muslims who are working with the New York law firms here. Does your firm write these contracts, Dan?
No, I don't know. For clients? Or
for clients. A client, if you have a client from Qatar, for example, from Qatar, or from all these Emirates, the Emirates.
I don't think I'm telling a tale out of school. You know, my wife's general counsel at
this
kind of.
Right.
They do a lot of this.
Oh, they do?
A lot of
this. Okay, so these are this kind of.
Big when you come in to the main,
I'm sure that this is probably a piece of their clientele. Piece of their clientele requires a loan to be written not as a loan, but rather as a partnership. Instead of a loan being a loan, it's a partnership where profit is allowed for the partners. But you have to reconstruct the nature of the transaction. So every transaction which in a normal bank would be a loan is a heter iska, according to the Torah bank, you have to write your transactions differently. Okay?
And my question is also, though, since it's a double punishment and it's so important, how did it come to be adhered to by so few people now?
Because the Western world, the history of this in the Western world, remember, was that the church accepted a lot of these ideas? And who were the people who the church was willing to use to create interest? Because in the development of the post-feudal economy, in a feudal economy, a lot was bartered, I assume. In a post-feudal economy, as soon as you had currency and you had trading going on throughout Europe, who were the people who were in different parts of Europe who are not subject to church law? For the Jews. So the Jews, first of all, in the development of the Western banking system, the Jews were key players because they were the only people permitted by the church to earn interest. And it was necessary, in terms of the development of a modern economy, to have loans and loans that bore interest. It was the only way to develop a modern economy. So in effect, the machine of the economy generated its own reality. Generated its own reality. You know, I don't know whether I'm sure you could study these things. I've never done it myself. I can imagine a study of, let's say, what later comes to be the Enlightenment and notions of humanity that are not based on religion. Essentially a secular notion of things. I can imagine a way of thinking about that it's all economically based. It's all because in the development of the modern economy, you needed it forced the notion of equality. That's the basis of capitalism. Capitalism really makes a lot of those things happen. And the modern economy was a capitalist economy. And every effort that was made to do anything different failed. I mean, you had a communist economy in a piece of the world, but it hasn't done very well. The only remnant of it is, I understand, a fairly capitalist Chinese economy today, but it's some sort of combination of the two. So I don't know a lot. I really can't answer your question, but it has something to do with those things.
Come to think of it, you can't set up like a banker Goy. You lend it to O'Reilly on the condition that O'Reilly lends it to Wexler and that Wexler pays back interest to O'Reilly.
Well, I can just tell you that Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan didn't want to do that, because the whole idea of founding a Jewish state was not to be based on a Shabbos Goy. That when Jews lived in the diaspora, they were dependent upon Gentiles. And that if Jews would finally have their own country, they would be able to live by their own laws in their own country.
As convoluted as they might be.
It's much better than being dependent upon the Gentile.
I've been trying to figure out how much of this has to do with the textbook. And it's not clear to me, because as you discuss what evolved,
It's a worthwhile question to keep in mind, just to what extent does one need intent. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of this, actually the rabbinic construction goes beyond intent. Rabbinic construction goes beyond intent, because it's so abstruse. It's so easy to get to do what you're not allowed to do, mm-hmm. that intent becomes, you know, almost irrelevant to the whole thing.
But is that the goal?
I don't know. At this point, let's okay. keep it, leave that in abeyance.
Mm-hmm. Huh? I was saying, the Torah itself in this passage from Deuteronomy says, "La'nachri tashif, la'achicha lo tashif." So there's something more than the principle of charging interest.
Absolutely. It's a social side to it. Definitely. Has to do with the nature of community. And the way people in a defined community have responsibility for each other, and we make sure that they do not deal with each other the way they would with the stranger. That's the language. I'm borrowing the language of the scriptures. It's not that there's anything wrong with that, the way that the stranger is dealt with. But in your own community, you have to deal differently. And I think that's a very essential idea to what is going on here. It is the creation of a certain set of relationships within the Jewish community which are beyond what would economically make sense.
It's a community creating.
Correct.
Community.
Exactly.
As opposed to, it's not just because perhaps the person is poor and needy. It's a little like not inviting a chreid to the Seder. There are some things where occasionally you have to sort of reinforce the foundation. There's nothing intrinsically that you would think wrong. You can always find some